Welcome, and thank you for listening to the Jizo An Zen Community's Dharma Talks. We are happy to make these recordings available to you. Please consider making a one-time or recurring donation via the link on our webpage found under Become a Member. We thank you wholeheartedly. Gassho.
I haven't been here for a few months, so... it's nice to be home. First and foremost, today is a somewhat of a special day. It's our teacher's third anniversary of his death today. So, which was a big change for all of us, as you can imagine. I don't know if anybody was ever at the Pinewood in Chemung, but. Very different setting, very beautiful place. So when our teacher passed, we had the choice of ending or moving along and starting with everything that he gave us, you know, and that's what we did. And we have this wonderful little place here. So thank you everybody for coming and keeping it alive and taking care of it. Just like everything in life, it needs to be taken care of, all things. So this is a poem that I have written for him, for his funeral. And I'd just like to share that before we go into the talk. It's titled Life's Death Poem. Blessed are you, great lion of light, a protector resting in the towering pines, watchful amongst the sleeping Buddhas. The drumming thunder of Dharma soaks through the sands of time. With each step, a passing imprint on these blessed pure lands. May you always carry the stick of the Taiko's beating heart, drumming out love's song. And now this mother stone returns to the warmth of the mountain's womb, the resting place of all giants. From every peak, the lion's roar is transmitted like the symphony of a million trumpets, each hand and bone, wing and claw, wind and snow, teacher going on. So I wrote something that's usually very dear to me. It's about the devil. Seems a little strange in Buddhism, but in Buddhism, the devil is usually referred to as Mara, M-A-R-A. And it's more seen as the temptress or the tempter, the fool, you know, the maker of obstacles, you know, all this. There's so many different names that we could give it. And at the moment of the Buddha's enlightenment, if you ever read about the week that he spent under the Bodhi tree, Mara showed up in 10,000 forms, showed up as war, showed up as fear, showed up as desire, showed up as lust, all these different forms showed up. And now when we say that stuff, we think these armies came from outside, but what the Buddha really finally saw was that they were all emitting from within himself. All of the desires, all of the fears, all of the lust was emitting from within him, his own self. And this was his great enlightenment, was that Mara was just an illusion, but a powerful illusion. And he saw very clearly that there was no evil outside of this illusion. Evil is the creation of one's own mind. Now, what we do with that becomes evil in the world, or it stays in the context of someone's mind. This is why we see evil in the world, because ignorance doesn't allow somebody to stop before they do that thing. Or sometimes we can even say, desire is more powerful than logic. I don't know if anybody can relate to that. Desire is more powerful than logic. which means I do something silly even though I know it will hurt. Just look at all addictions. You know, this is the underlying definition of addiction. You know, this is gonna get me, but I'll try anyway. You know. So I wrote some stuff on Mara, Dancing with Mara. So what happens in deep solitude? Mara shows up. Just try it. Go home. Maybe start tomorrow morning. Don't go to work. Don't do a chore. Don't turn on the television. Don't turn on music. Don't pick up your phone. Do nothing at all. And see how long it lasts. Mara shows up. She shows up in the context of, what are you doing? This is stupid. You're wasting your life. You're wasting your time. You should be doing better things. Mara shows up like this too. I don't know if anybody had Mara show up when we were walking Kinhin and how strange it is. How many people thought it was so weird or stupid. You know, this is dumb. It's like creeping through the room with all these people. It'd be really weird if we were all naked. Just imagine that for a moment. That would be weird. Jogam Trungpa says, it's very easy to undress in a room by yourself. It's very difficult to get naked in front of a room full of strangers. Now, of course, he's talking about the internal nakedness, you know. Not so much our clothing. But that's one way to do it, too. If you want to find out where you stand in life, go out naked. So Mara shows up. Mara is the roadblock of liberation. Mara halts me in my tracks. Instantaneously, and I'm the last one to know it. Each one of us is the last one to know this. It's so easy to go down so many pathways on this, and you know, we touch into what the ego is and what the ego is not. But all of it, we can really just say in a very basic way, is born out of this sense of self, this sense of a separate me, a separate entity. And from that, all of this stuff grows. All of these stories, all of the illusions, all of the desires grow from this separateness of self. The world is unfixable, said Buddha. It is the mind that can, should, and must be fixed. Now when most of us hear that, we hear like it kind of sounds a little bleak. But what he's saying, when he means the world is unfixable, he means reality is reality. You are born, you will die, you experience sickness and old age, you will experience gain and loss. That's what he meant by the world is unfixable. Those are all natural aspects of being alive, right? Every one of us experiences that. Some more than others, some less than others. So the Buddha said the world is unfixable. That is just natural reality. So what's the problem? The problem resides in my mind. I don't like to get sick. I don't like to lose stuff. I don't like to give stuff up. And instantaneously, when those things arise for us, suffering follows. Instantaneously. So much that none of us even realize it's suffering. So it's interesting, Buddhism, this term, the world or nature, they also relate it to the mind. You know, we call it our brain, but in Buddhism there's the brain, the little pink gooey thing between our ears, and then there's the mind. And we say that this mind, this brain of ours, has some sort of ability to tap into consciousness, which we call the mind, the great mind, the universal mind. And so, from that point alone, if this is so, which I believe it to be so, if this is so, it is impossible to be a separate entity in this living organism called life. It's impossible. It means that I am a part of you in every single way. When you suffer, I also suffer, unless I try to ignore it. When you're happy, I also experience happiness. This is why when you're scrolling on a TV or on your phone and a little picture of a starving child comes up, really quick, you go by that very fast. Oh, no thank you. Because when we see suffering, you instantaneously relate it to your own life. You see it within your own self. You can't not. There's a really, it's a terrible documentary, but it's, I believe it's called Human, and it's about animal abuse. And if anybody's able to get through that without bawling their eyes out, I highly doubt it, but I'd be really surprised. But it shows what happens in that realm, you know. And the same thing when we watch images and documentaries of abuse on humans in the world, you know. If you're really to watch it and really pay attention to it, you can't not suffer from it, you know. So what should our minds be fixed of? If the world is unfixable and the mind can be fixed, what are we fixing? We're trying to fix these illusions. We're trying to free ourselves of all of these fantasies. And the fantasies go like this. Life should be like this, and it shouldn't be like that. That's a fantasy. My belief is better than your belief. That's a fantasy. My opinion matters more than yours. That's a fantasy. I'm ugly. That's a fantasy. I'm beautiful. This is a fantasy. All of these things that we take for so common and so normal in our life, these all turn into this fetish of oneself, if you think about that. It's one of my favorite little sayings. I may not be much, but I'm all I think about. And this is the process of this little ego mind. And really underneath of it is the process of Mara. In a very simple way, a thought or vision can easily turn into a fantasy or a nightmare. The truth is, most humans have no idea about the amount of effort that we put towards the illusions. The amount of effort that we put into our fantasies. Constantly calculating, rehashing, planning, projecting, fantasizing. The amazing part about Zazen, if you really practice Zazen, especially for some long periods, you can't not but recognize your fantasies. Mara shows up. What happens in deep solitude? Mara shows up. Our teacher used to say, when you sit down, everything sits down with you. It all shows up. So, in some sense, to sit Zazen takes some courage. It really does. Especially if you're going to stay with it, you're going to have to find some courage. Because sometimes, and I know this to be true for a lot of us, when those really ugly ones come knocking, my knee-jerk reaction is to leave. No thank you. But it's just the temptress. It's not alive anymore. This is the amazing part about the mind. It reacts exactly as if that thing is happening again. This is what they mean by karma. Karma means to relive something. So if I have an old traumatic thing that happened when I was a kid, and I start to think about it, the feelings that arise in the body are the same exact result of when it happened. Now we may not throw a tantrum, or we may not run and hide under a bed, but I'll escape somehow, because I can't stand looking at it. I can't stand the feelings that come up from it. So this is where Sangha is so important. We need a community of people to take care of us while we go through this, to help us along the road. This is where the teachings are so important. So I can remember, this is an old story. This isn't even real right now. It feels real, but it's not real. This is how wisdom is born, you know, when we use these different things. The release of the grip, even for a few moments, is nirvana, while the grip, of course, is mara. The release of the grip, even for a few moments, is nirvana, while the grip, of course, is mara. So if you think about this for your own life, say you meet somebody that has a completely opposite view, it doesn't matter what it is, religion, politics, humans, whatever it is, and they start spouting off about their belief, right? Their opinion. The minute I start hearing it, and it's so opposite of mine, I go, nope. And the minute that I do that, suffering begins, because all of a sudden I want them to shut up. I want them to leave, especially if it's something I really don't like. Suffering is born right in that minute. If I can let go of that grip and say, maybe there's something here to learn from, you know? Maybe I've been too hard about this one issue in my whole life, and I've missed something really important about it. This takes practice, of course, but that little line is so powerful. The release of the grip, even for a few moments, is nirvana. Because instantaneously I become open. And I say, wait a minute, maybe this person needs to just talk. Maybe this person needs just to air out something right now. And all of a sudden we offer them that space to do that. That's wonderful. Man. Even if I still don't agree with it, it's fine. No big deal. But the minute that the grip comes back, and I don't know about anybody else, mine fluctuates. I go, okay, they're fine. And then they say something else, and I go, argh. And I go, okay, they're fine. It's a crazy little game. The mind loves playing games, you know? So he wrote, this was written by Stephen Batchelor, that little quote. And they went on to write something similar. Whatever is contingent is naturally at ease. Nagarjuna. Whatever is contingent is naturally at ease. And so the word contingent means subject to change or existing only in certain aspects, certain conditions. So this line is really beautiful. It's a really beautiful line if we're able to bring it into our life. So when something is just being, when I just allow this bell to be, it's completely at ease. It has no fight to it. The minute that I say there's something wrong with this bell, the sound is lousy, all that stuff, the grip happens, you know, instantaneously. So whatever is contingent is naturally at ease. Now, if you ask most people in life, which I think is really interesting, most people say, oh, I don't have a little voice in my head. Until you sit down in meditation. And then you go, I can't stop my brain. And you go, we know. That's not the point. The point is to see the mind. Kind of to taste it, you know? I want to see what is happening there. Because there's a habitual mechanism that has been running continuously from the moment that each of us were born. And every one of ours sounds a little bit different, you know? A little uniqueness. In that voice. Same context, different story. It's kind of like you walk into a library. It's just a whole bunch of books. Different stories, but a bunch of books. Yeah. Same thing with us. So logically, most of us know that when we have a thought in the mind, it's just a thought. But in Buddhism, we see this very different. This is the birth of an action. If left unattended to, you know? And we all know that anything, even the smallest thought, whether it's a good thought or a terrible thought, can grow into something horrible, you know, or something beautiful. for most of us, because we don't understand the mechanism of our mind, the minute that these thoughts, these visions, these remembrances awaken in our life, we are instantaneously drawn into an emotional reaction. Instantaneously. It happens like that. Think about somebody you don't like right now. If you just mull it over for a minute, all of a sudden your fists might start clenching, your shoulders might come up a little bit, might start sweating a little bit, it's shaking in your seat. Instantaneously, an emotional reaction is born. And then the story deepens, the emotion rises, the story deepens. This is the crazy little cycle that it goes into. Now most of us, don't act out on most of these things. But we still experience them throughout the entire day, throughout our entire life. And this is what we really find that keeps us stuck so often. This is why we miss so much of life. Because I'm living in this crazy little dreamlike state. One story after another. One story after another. One feeling after another. Anybody else take pleasure in anger? Oh, it's like a drug. Are you kidding me? Anger is powerful. Fear can be very powerful. Victims can be very powerful. Victimhood. All these things. So the more the emotional and mental energies that arise from these stories, the more real and powerful the belief is upon them. So as we're growing, as we're children, we don't have the capacity to say, oh, this person is just crazy right now, or this person is just angry right now. We look at this as a true threat. You know, maybe it's our parent or our sibling or even a stranger that maybe is frightening us. We don't have the capacity to step back and look at it from a logical standpoint. We can only look at it from a fear standpoint, a place of survival. And the minute that those happen, and if they happen enough times, a habit is born in that moment, a habit of protecting oneself. And this stays with us for our entire lives. It changes and molds and morphs into new situations. This is why when we all meet somebody new, we're all on our best behavior. Hey, how's it going? Nice to see you. You know, and then 2 weeks later or 2 years later, you know, we're throwing pots and pans across the kitchen. Dzongkhar Jamyang Khyentse said, if it is not paradoxical, it is not spiritual. If it is not paradoxical, it is not spiritual. And really what he means by this is that our logical way of dealing with life keeps us stuck in samsara, keeps us stuck in suffering. So the paradoxical is always this stepping back, you know? And this is what Zen really offers us. It offers us a way of pausing. I'm going to paint this little sign, and it says really small, if you wish to find yourself, please be quiet. Because I need to get quiet to understand what's happening here. I need to get quiet here, and I need to get quiet here. If I don't, this thing just keeps on spinning them out, you know? It's like the ticket at Wall Street, you know? Just shooting them out. All the stories, all the reasons, all the excuses, you know. This is another quote from Stephen Batchelor, which is really why I wrote this. If anybody's ever heard me offer Dharma talks, I always talk about addiction because it's been my co-pilot in life, you know, and not always a good one. But it brought me to the Dharma. So Stephen Batchelor wrote a book called, he's a Buddhist theologian. He wrote a book called Living with the Devil, which is kind of what spurred me to write this Dharma talk. If the devil's circle spins consoling fictions of a self and world that are unambiguous, controllable, and self-evident, then nirvana, as the stilling of that spin, discloses a self and world that are ambiguous, uncontrollable, and perplexing. So ambiguous is uncertain or doubtful. Unambiguous, we say, no, it's this way. So our normal way of thinking is, says, life is this way and it can't be that way. And as long as I live from that place, I will live in a state of suffering, whether it's mild suffering or great suffering. It doesn't matter. I was talking to a junkie one time, and he was a real deal junkie. I mean, he lived in the streets. His feet were like three times the size of his normal feet. He had track marks everywhere. I mean, he's a mess. But he was such a brilliant guy. Such a wonderful guy. And he's still alive. I still see him wandering around sometimes. I can't believe he's still alive. Shepherd. His name's Shepherd. And it was before Christmas, and I had seen him, and I said, hey, Shepherd, come here. And I just wanted to talk to him. And I just flat out asked him, I said, is this the life that you think, is this the best life that you think you can live? And he said, there's nothing greater than heroin. He flat out said that to me. There's nothing greater than heroin. I want no other life. I don't want a life without heroin. And I shook his hand, I gave him a hug, and I gave him $30. And I said, all right, take it easy. In a way, it's kind of like I was saying goodbye to him, because who knows what's going to happen. $30 will kill you. But who am I to say he's wrong? You know, in his world, in his pain, that's the only thing he's got. So this world that says it should be like this is wrong. And that's a hard thing for us to swallow. It really is hard for us to swallow. But life is like this. It's so wild. It is so wild. Just go into the forest and look in the forest. The forest is an amazing rendition of all life, natural life. It's just growing like this. The trees are bent and falling and dying and living and growing. It's all happening right there. The second part of that is so important. He says, then nirvana, as the stilling of that spin, discloses a self and world that are ambiguous. My life is uncertain. I have no idea what's going to happen the minute I walk out of here. I have no idea. My heart could stop in 2 seconds. That's the truth. We all know this. Nobody likes to look at it. But we all know this. I may not make it home on my ride home tonight. I might get stuck. These guys had to come get me a couple times. My old beat up truck out there. I don't know what's going to happen in life. I said my daughter is full of fear. She's 17, started driving, and she got a little job. We live in Toms River. So she got a little job across on the beach in La Valette. She didn't want to drive across the bridge. She was scared of driving across the bridge. So her mom and grandma kept kind of like taking her to work and picking her up. And finally I said, that's enough. I gave you a car, so I didn't have to be your taxi driver anymore. I said, you have to drive to work today. No, Dad, I'm not doing it. No, I said, well, you can do that or you can walk. She said, all right. So she drove to work, and then I met her after. She called me up. I have such a cool relationship with this kid. Called me up, hey, you want to go sit and watch the sunset with me? I said, all right, I'll meet you over there. So we're sitting and yapping and she's telling me about her afternoon. She says, thanks for making me drive to work today. She was grateful because she faced that silly little fear. Yeah. It could have gone another way. She could have just not talked to me for a couple days or a week. Who knows? But she did it and she learned from it. Yeah. Life is uncertain. This self is uncertain. Life is uncontrollable. Try it. Try to control it. Try to tie it down. It's impossible. Try to Tie your family down. See what happens. They will buck and kick and scream and bite. Right? Right? And it is perplexing. This is the spiritual road. All three of those. It is uncertain. It is uncontrollable. And it is perplexing. But when we find this way of really becoming intrigued by that, really diving into the wonder of it all, this is why we call it a mystery. When you really find a way to dive into that, life changes. And then all of a sudden this Buddha mind is born. The Buddha mind awakens. The Buddha heart awakens. I think it's just like that. We must become intrigued by it all. But to do that, I must see all the roadblocks, you know. And there's a lot of roadblocks. In Buddhism, we say there's 10,000. 10,000 distractions. 10,000 maras. Remember the old Tom and Jerry? The little devil and boy, I used to love that. And I always rooted for the devil, of course. I was a little devil myself. I'm so grateful for that too. Well, I don't want to go too much longer. Does anybody have anything they want to, any questions or anything they want to say? Sometimes we go like, whew, too much. They get on a pair of skis and can't stop. Spiritual life is nothing more than an investigation. And from my own experience, it is immense and daunting at times. And mostly because I wish it to be different than that. I wish it to be quick and painless. I always think about, you know, maybe the people that crossed this country back in the 1700s, and maybe they got a snake bite, and all of a sudden they said, well, you got to chop your foot off. You better bite down on this stick. Sometimes Buddhism is like that. you gotta hold on tight because the ride gets kind of crazy. I want life to be easy. I want it to be painless. I want it to be fun and bubbly all the time, and it cannot be that. Thich Nhat Hanh said, "Life is both wonderful and horrifying." And this, you know, sometimes I definitely go down into a little darker way, but. And I don't mean to do it in that sense, but I also know that the way each one of us holds into these beliefs, when those beliefs crumble, we crumble. So this isn't about like, it's not about just throwing something away. I must investigate the validity of it. I must find out if my beliefs are real or not. Do they hold any real value to them? Or are they just good ideas or weird ideas? You know? When we fight, we suffer. When we let go, we find liberation. When we accept or allow things to be as they are, we taste what Buddha called liberation. When we try to fix or keep things in a mold, we suffer. I want to put everything in its little box. I suffer. Every word, definition, every explanation is Mara's playground. So all of this stuff is really here for us to investigate for myself, for ourselves. You know, it's kind of like, if you have a great opinion, watch the story that shows up when somebody doesn't respect your opinion. Watch the story that comes behind it, and how long and how in-depth that story is, you know. Our natural response is just to get mad at the person and think about all the bad things that they do. But if you're able to step back and say, what is my story here? What is my part in this piece? Then I start to have this different experience with it. I stop doing this, you know, and I start going, what's going on here? Mara and Buddha are entwined with each other. To pretend that either can exist in isolation is to fall prey to Mara's oldest trick, oldest trick, tearing a conditioned thing out of the matrix in which it lives and raising it to the status of an unconditioned truth. Stephen Batchelor. Or to say in simple terms, Buddha and Mara are one. Buddha saw through the veil of Mara's whispering lies. So all of this is this crazy play going on within each one of us. This was the story of the Buddha, you know. As he sat under the Bodhi tree and he had this enlightenment experience, at that moment he saw through the veil of Buddha, of Mara. And that's when he placed his hand on the earth. And he said, today myself and all beings are already Buddha. We are already okay. We're already complete. If I could only get out of the way of the stories, if I could only set them aside. So I can't do that just from a thinking place, although thinking is important. I can't do that just from a meditating place, although meditation is important. I can't do that from just a reading place, although reading is important. I must learn how to intertwine all three of those. For this is how wisdom is born. When all three of these aspects are brought together, just like Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, they create this indestructible force.